You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Hi, I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate today, and it's a great time to throw a substitute host into an NPR situation because we have lots of ups and downs with the network telling us when the president is going to speak. At any moment, I may be interrupted by the president from the White House talking about the Supreme Court upholding the Affordable Care Act, which, as many of you know, happened a short time ago. So I may have to jump out at any moment. But let's pretend that we're having a good time and just plow on forward. We have a very exciting show today. We're going to be talking, of course, later about the Supreme Court's decision about the whole saga of the Affordable Care Act. That will be coming up a little bit later. We're going to be talking to author Chad Harbach about his novel, The Art of Fielding, which is the latest installment of the Leonard Lopate Show Book Club. And we're going to also be talking about another big cornerstone policy of the Obama administration, which is, of course, the war in Afghanistan, the prosecution of the war in Afghanistan. That brings me to my first guest tonight. The decade-long fight in Afghanistan, of course, has become one of our nation's longest wars, and according to the Department of Defense, more than 2,000 American service members have died as part of that effort. Well, in his new book, Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan, senior correspondent and associate editor of The Washington Post, Rajiv Chandrasekaran, have I gotten that right?
You nailed it. Yep.
First time, offers a searing indictment of how the Obama administration has handled the war. The book is published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased it has brought Rajiv to our show today. Welcome.
Great to be here.
So I hope you don't feel in any way upstaged by what's going on in Washington today.
Not in the least. When the president speaks, let's go and hear what he has to say. It's certainly a big news day over here.
I mean, it's actually pertinent to what we're talking about because I would say that health care was certainly one of President Obama's biggest campaign promises, agenda items, and it's occupied a good deal of his first term in office. He also talked about winding down the war in Iraq, which depending on your definition of winding down, I guess, is happening. But a lot of people who voted for President Obama thinking he was kind of a peace candidate or the dove in the race may have ignored the fact that he actually talked about prosecuting the war in Afghanistan rather aggressively. Why do you think that President Obama made that a priority as opposed to Iraq, which I guess he determined was a bad cause?
That's a great question. And this actually is a good fit for a day like today. We have the Supreme Court ruling on the signature domestic policy initiative. The war in Afghanistan is his signature foreign policy initiative as part of the overall war on terrorism and the efforts to constrain al-Qaeda. Going back to the 2008 campaign, Iraq, as you noted, was the bad war for Obama.
Right.
Implicitly there, Afghanistan became the good war. He couldn't, as a young Democratic presidential candidate, be seen to be opposing both wars.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he was seen in some circles as a peace candidate, he didn't want to put himself into that box. And so he didn't just leave open the room for doing more in Afghanistan. He campaigned on doing so. He said, I'm going to send additional troops there. I'm going to have a new strategy for reconstruction and development, a new political engagement strategy. The issue, though, was that back then, to Obama and his advisors, and quite frankly to many Americans, the price tag for doing so was much less than it turned out to be. Back when he was campaigning, what he thought Afghanistan needed was another combat brigade or two,
mm-hmm.
5, 10, 15,000 soldiers, not much more than that. That was certainly what commanders on the ground were asking for. The issue is when he took office, the requests started increasing. And then he was put in the position of, do I side with my commanders and give them what they want, or do I take a different approach, one that's more narrowly tailored at going after al-Qaeda, big fish Taliban actors, but shying away from a grand effort to remake Afghanistan?
Mm-hmm. This is Andy Borowitz sitting in for Leonard Lopate. I just want to remind our listeners that we will be bringing you President Obama's speech when that happens. We're waiting for that to happen. But in the meantime, I'm having a very interesting conversation about Afghanistan with Rajiv Chandrasekaran. I've done it now three times, I think. I've gotten that name out of my mouth, so I'm very impressed by that effort.
Before we're done here, I'll make you say it 10 times fast.
Now, you said something interesting, which I just wanted to get back to, which is you said, as a young Democratic senator, President Obama couldn't oppose both the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Do you think that this hawkish position on Afghanistan is born partially out of political expediency, or do you think this is something that he really believes this is a good war? This is in the U.S. interest to plow all these additional resources into it?
I think early on, there were both of those factors were at play, Andy. Mm-hmm. I think that certainly politics played a role. He didn't want to perhaps pick a fight with the Republicans over this issue. Had he rejected troop increased requests from his generals early in his presidency, it certainly would have opened himself up to fire from the right. But I think he honestly felt – now, look, I can't peer inside his head, but I do think from talking to his advisors, from doing the research for the book, I think both as a candidate and then in his initial year in office, he felt that if some additional military force were applied – plus additional civilian resources and some more money, that this war that was so badly mismanaged by the Bush administration could be turned around, or at least you could get to a good enough outcome. So I think he early on felt that you could do it.
Okay, I think we are going to be cutting to the White House. That was President Obama speaking from the East Room of the White House. He was responding to today's ruling by the Supreme Court, which upheld much of his landmark health care law. And we're going to be talking about that ruling and the president's response later in today's show. This is Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate. I'll be back with Rajiv Chandrasekaran and his new book, Little America, after this. This is Andy Borowitz sitting in for Leonard Lopate on WNYC and WNYC.org. Well, after all that excitement, we're back to our little show. And I'm very happy because I'm sitting here talking to Mr. Rajiv Chandrasekaran about his new book, Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. Rajiv is a senior correspondent and associate editor of The Washington Post. Is that a tough act for you to follow? That's the president of the United States, and he seemed pretty stoked about what just happened, although I thought controlling himself, not appearing to do a victory dance of any kind.
It was constrained chest beating. Tough act to follow. We'll try our best here.
Well, we'll try. Well, we'll try to go from the wonky world of healthcare reform to the
Even more wonky world of
Afghanistan. Now, I want to talk a little bit about, I think the title of your book, Little America, is a great title, and you must have been excited when you thought of it, because it sort of sums up the whole metaphor of what exactly we're doing in Afghanistan. Tell us what exactly Little America is, because I had no idea that this even existed.
So there's a great backstory here, and like many stories out there, it actually begins, Andy, with the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. In the late 30s, Jewish fur traders fled Central Europe and resettled in New York, and they needed a new source for pelts, for hats and coats. And they turned to Afghanistan for the fur of the Persian fat-tailed sheep. And in those years, in the late 30s and early 40s, Afghanistan exported something like 1 million to 2 million fur pelts a year to the United States. The sale of each one put a few more dollars in the Afghan government's treasury. So at the end of World War II, when Europe was digging out of its rubble, Afghanistan was sitting on a comparative windfall. And the young king in Kabul was so impressed by what we in America had done during the Depression with the Tennessee Valley Authority that he wanted to do something similar in the southern part of his country. He wanted to turn a barren desert into a verdant agricultural oasis. So he hired the American firm that had built the San Francisco Bay Bridge and the Hoover Dam to come to southern Afghanistan and build dams and a network network of canals that they hoped would really give the country agricultural self-sufficiency. And so in the late 40s and early 50s, dozens of Americans showed up in Afghanistan to work on this project. And we think that America's engagement in Afghanistan began with 9/11 or with the Soviet invasion and our support for the Mujahideen.
Yeah.
It actually began more than six decades ago, in the very same terrain where Obama's surge would play out in 2009 and 10. And so these Americans needed a place to live. And so they built for themselves a brand new town, a town they thought the Afghans would look at and aspire to sort of create for themselves. It was initially eight square blocks. And unlike every building in Afghanistan in the past and even today, it didn't have big tall walls that prevented you from looking in. These were American-style suburban homes with manicured front lawns. They had the country's only back then and still today. Well, it's not there today, but it was this one brief period in time. The only co-ed swimming pool, only co-ed high school. They had a clubhouse with a Filipino bartender who made potent gin and tonics. They had nightly card games, weekly dances. And so the Afghans looked to this community and they said, that's Little America. And that's where the inspiration for the title of the book comes from. But there's a broader story to this that I spill out in the beginning of the book, and that is that entire development effort was really plagued with an awful lot of problems. The Americans failed to really understand Afghanistan, failed to work with the Afghans. The contractor that came in to do all the work fleeced the Afghans. They insisted every piece of equipment had to be brought from the United States. You change the dates, you change the names, you could be writing about today.
That sounds very, very familiar.
It does. And I thought it was worth reminding readers or telling readers that these sort of shenanigans that we write about today actually have their roots and stuff decades ago, and in the very same places. You know, what we are trying to do today, we have Marines fighting and dying in canals that our grandfather's generation built in Afghanistan.
So what we were all in Afghanistan. We've been there a long, long time in various forms, and we were there for a kind of economic reasons, although I guess a lot of times you could argue that a lot of military efforts have a pretty strong economic component or rationale, despite what the leaders may say at the time. We were there in the 40s, as you said. How did that in any way affect the communist takeover? Was it 1978?
79, yeah.
Yeah. Was that Barbak? Kamal? What was
yeah, and then, yes, and it was the Sour Revolution, and then very quickly thereafter, Soviet tanks rolled into Afghanistan. And what happened? So this project was flawed for many years. You know, the canals weren't built in the right places. The fields got waterlogged. Finally, and the Americans tried all sorts of approaches to fix this. Like they said, oh, why don't we just move the Afghans off the land and bulldoze it? And of course, the Afghans freaked out because they thought they'd never get their land back. So they met the American bulldozers with rifles. Finally, in the mid-70s, we came up with a real plan to fix this failing project. Problem was by the time we actually started to implement it, Soviet tanks rolled in. And so it was thoroughly unfinished. Fast forward a couple of years. All of these sort of waterlogged fields, it wasn't working very well. What was the one crop that actually could grow there? Opium-producing poppies.
Yes,
and we
the mainstay.
We managed to turn southern Afghanistan into the world's the largest producer of opium-producing poppies in the world.
I'm Andy Borowitz. I'm sitting in for Leonard Lopate at WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm talking to Rajiv Chandrasekaran about his new book, Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. So Soviets come in, and I guess in our narrative at the time, we saw their involvement in Afghanistan as becoming kind of the beginning of the end of the Soviet Union. It was their Vietnam. We would crow in a very kind of superior way. I'm not exactly sure what entitled us to that air of superiority, but they left the country and left it to the Taliban. Given the history of American involvement, when we got involved again after September 11th, did we decide it was going to be different this time? Did we have a more long-range plan? Did we decide we were going to really nation build? What was our What was our stated goal at that point, besides getting bin Laden?
You know, Andy, I wish I could sit here and tell you that we went back and looked at all that stuff we'd done earlier and said, all right.
It's on the internet.
It's on the internet. It's in the files at the U.S. Agency for International Development at the State Department. It's all there.
Right.
Nobody read it. Nobody bothered to go back, or at least most people didn't, maybe a few little bureaucrats here and there. So we never really engaged with what we had done before. It was like history was beginning anew after 9/11.
Right.
And we thought, all right, we're going to go in and we're going to, you know, rebuild this country. And the truth being told, we probably could have done a pretty good job had we focused on it in those early years. But as soon as we topple the Taliban, it's a story that many of your listeners know well. The United States took its eye off the ball in Afghanistan. The Bush administration was set on invading Iraq, and so we pulled out troops, we pulled out civilian reconstruction resources, and we essentially created an opening for the Taliban to come back into the country, and we failed to provide the necessary resources to President Hamid Karzai to really build up his government. And so it was our inattention that helped to fuel the problems that we face there now, and is what left Afghanistan such a mess when Obama took office in 2009.
Okay, so he took office then, and he had this idea of the surge. Did it come directly from him? Was it his thought? Who was his advisor that said this is a good idea?
Well, the desire for the surge came from the military, and
is it because they felt that it had worked in Iraq?
And they said, all right, this was the medicine that cured Baghdad, even though it really didn't. You look at Iraq today; it's still very violent, and many of the reasons why things changed in Baghdad had less to do with the infusion of additional troops. But the military took the lesson that we sent more troops there, things improved. Mm-hmm. So we could do the same in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. The problem was that Afghanistan, it's a very different country.
Right, of course.
And that's stating the obvious. But, you know, what the fundamental truth that the U.S. government didn't quite get was that for the Afghan people, they have no great love for the Taliban. You know, the Taliban's promise law and order and swift justice, often in the form of a lopped off hand, but the Afghans have lived through the Taliban, and they don't really want them back, but they don't like their government either. They see their government as filled with warlords, corrupt thieves, people who shake them down for bribes on the road, people who abduct young boys for pleasure. I mean, it's filled with some terrible characters. And we went in and we said, if we send in more troops with a surge, we're gonna implement the strategy called counterinsurgency. We're gonna help bring the government to you, dear people of Afghanistan. We're gonna send professional men from Kabul down and open your schools and do this and that. Well, to the Afghan people, they were like, whoa, wait a second. You're going to bring us more of our government? Well, we don't like that.
Right.
And so they were never really willing partners in all of this. Now, President Obama's civilian advisors, I think, grasped a lot of this.
Like Biden and people like that, Holbrooke.
Led by Vice President Biden, led by a number of key officials on the National Security Council staff. Officials at the State Department were also very skeptical. But the military had a different view. They really felt that if you send in the troops, we can do this. And ultimately, the president sided with his commanders over his civilian advisors.
Now, what were Richard Holbrooke's views? What was the basis of his opposition to the surge?
Well, so Holbrooke plays a very interesting game here, because Holbrooke did not think the surge was going to work. Holbrooke, this towering figure, this great American diplomat, at 27 years old, he was the youngest American to serve on the Paris peace talks to try to end the Vietnam War. He ended the Balkan War in the mid-90s with the Dayton Peace Accords. He was a remarkable figure. But also very divisive. He was, had many enemies and ruffled a lot of feathers within the administration.
Why was that? Was it his personality?
Yeah.
Was it his approach?
It was all about, in many ways, it was all about personality. He treated senior officials at the White House like errand boys. He had very sharp elbows. Mm-hmm. But he thought that the only way to really end this war was through some sort of peace deal with the Taliban. That we're never going to achieve an outright military victory.
And didn't the Saudis also want that? Didn't they want Holbrooke to talk to?
Well, so you had the Saudi government, you had other other nations and other actors who all wanted to see an outcome like this. Here is the problem. The White House also wanted this. But what I detail in this book was the really nasty infighting between Holbrooke and the White House. The White House couldn't stand him. So instead of working for the common purpose of trying to find a way to negotiate to end this conflict, the civilian advisors were so consumed fighting amongst themselves. And they did silly things. They prevented Holbrooke from using military aircraft to go to the country. If he was out of Washington, they'd schedule key meetings. They once even tried to exclude him from an Oval Office meeting between Obama and President Karzai. And their plan, this is some of the president's advisors, was to slip talking points to President Obama, saying, everybody in this room represents me and has my trust. The implicit suggestion to Karzai being, Holbrooke, who's not here, doesn't have the president's trust. It was foiled at the last minute when Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, insisted Holbrooke come in. She was his only real defender, and it got to such a point that when the White House actually tried to fire him, Clinton had to march over to see Obama at the White House and say, Mr. President, you can fire Richard Holbrooke over the objections of your Secretary of State. I mean, this is remarkable. At this level at the administration, you know, so we're sending tens of thousands more troops there. You have Americans fighting and dying. They deserve to have, at the very top levels of the government, senior officials working together. There can be legitimate disagreements, but you know, this got really petty and really personal. And our government should have been better than that. They should have risen above it.
So do you lay a lot of this at Obama's feet, that Obama, he's the boss, and he's got these squabbling subordinates who are really getting in each other's way. Was there no moment where he said, "Hey guys, what's the plan? Let's all get on the same page here"?
There were times he sort of pushed to get resolution, but the fighting continued. And I'm sympathetic to Obama because he was in an untenable position. You know, he had by appointing Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, he essentially had to give her the flexibility and the freedom to choose who she wanted at the State Department. So when she brought in Holbrooke, who was a close friend, it was going to be too politically difficult for him to tell her, sack him. At the same time, all of his advisors didn't like him. And so I think, you know, my sense was that they were hoping that they would come to some sort of meaningful resolution, but the problem was the fighting persisted. The president should have stepped in and either said, you know, Holbrooke, it's not working and we're going to get rid of you, or told his team to all get on the same page. The problem was that never really happened.
Okay, so we're into 2009 and 2010. They make this decision, for better or worse. President Obama is going to send 30,000 troops, and they're going to join the Marines. And this was a really interesting point that I guess I kind of missed when this was all going on, which is they chose to send these troops down to Helmand, which is in the South.
Yep.
And this is where your legendary Little America is located. So the scene of our former triumph. And Helmand is home to fewer than 2% of the country's population. So why there? You don't have that many troops in Afghanistan, but if you're going to have a surge, why do it in a place that's so thinly populated?
That's a great question, right? If you're going to send additional forces, right, don't you want to put them against your most important problems, your most critical areas? So why? You know, this again goes back some years. It goes back to World War II. It goes back to Marines fighting on islands in the Pacific and feeling like they didn't get enough support from the Navy. So when the Marines decided to deploy to Afghanistan, they said, we need to be in a place where we can bring our own helicopters, our own supply convoys. They essentially wanted their own little patch of the sandbox.
Right.
And the only place that could be carved out and given to them was this part of Helmand Province that actually was home to fewer than 1% of the country's population. So they were given a patch. They insisted on a patch of irrelevant desert.
Okay. Well, on that note, I want to get back to that because irrelevant desert, I think, is a good cliffhanger. I'm speaking with Rajiv Chandrasekaran about the war in Afghanistan. His book, Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan, is published by Knopf. We'll have more after a break. I'm Andy Borowitz, still sitting in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm talking to Rajiv Chandrasekaran about his book, Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. Rajiv is the senior correspondent and associate editor of The Washington Post. And this book is a searing indictment of how the Obama administration has handled the war. So, okay, we were last talking about how we sent this surge of 30,000 troops down to, I think, what you called an irrelevant stretch of desert or something like that. So this story is getting worse and worse. So meanwhile, there aren't even a lot of Taliban down there where the surge is going, are there?
There are actually a lot of Taliban, and there are a lot of poppy fields. It's a bad place. Don't let me suggest otherwise.
Right.
But in the universe of bad places in Afghanistan, and there is no dearth of bad places there,
right.
and no dearth of places where the Taliban are, you know, rearing their heads and doing really terrible things. Next door in Kandahar province,
right.
Kandahar is home to the country's second largest city. It's really the spiritual heartland for the Taliban. If they recaptured Kandahar, they'd have a springboard to take over the whole nation, much like they did in the 1990s. So that was the key place you had to defend, in my view and in the view of many military commanders and other Afghanistan experts. So instead of defending that key terrain, it's sort of like if the United States was being invaded, wouldn't you want to defend sort of New York to Washington, D.C., as sort of a key corridor? Instead of doing that, you know, it's like we sent the troops out to Idaho. We went and fought in places where there were bad guys to kill, there were people to help, but it wasn't the most important, essential place. And by doing so, I argue that we squandered a year of the war, time that could have been better spent trying to fix things over in Kandahar and then perhaps in other parts of the country. Now, look, I acknowledge that there is a broader question here, whether the strategy as a whole could have worked, and I'm very skeptical that a big counterinsurgency strategy would have worked. That we needed more troops there. So on one level, the whole president's troop search, I think, was a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
But if you accept that that's what he did and that was his strategy, then how was that strategy carried out? And what I found was that it was screwed up by everybody. The Pentagon sent the troops to the wrong places. The State Department sent its civilians late. Most of them stayed in Kabul, in the capital, as opposed to getting out into the field where they needed to go. The U.S. Development Agency wound up pouring in way more money than the country needed. So if you take that, all right, look, this was the strategy, even if we can disagree with it, but this is what the president wanted to do, you'd hope that the organs of government beneath him would actually carry it out the right way. And the problem was they didn't.
And in Helmand, there were already British troops.
Yes.
And so we now have this relationship between the Americans who were part of the surge and the British. How did those two forces get along?
We're supposed to be great allies, right? The special relationship, you know.
We love their weddings, yeah.
We do.
We do.
You know, we forget about that, you know, that war 200 years ago. But yes. And in fact, you know, Prince Harry fought there in Helmand for a little while. But what happened was by sending so many troops to Helmand, we really upset the balance with the British. They wanted us to come and give them some assistance. But instead, we came in with essentially a big takeover strategy. And the British were just as dismayed as many American officials as the Marines sort of pushed into these abandoned towns and remote villages.
Well, now you've inspired a call, actually. We have a caller whose name is Dan, and he says he knew Holbrooke in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll hear about that. And let's hear what he has to say about the Holbrooke problem. Dan?
First of all, your author is probably one of the best on Iraq and Afghanistan that I know of, who's still alive. Second of all, though, I would say that it's a big mistake to read Holbrooke as a guy who wanted an end rather than something for himself. And this is the big tragedy with that man.
Well, Dan, before you continue, you say you knew Holbrooke in Vietnam. How did that
I was there, sent on several missions to observe how the pacification program was going on, and on that basis I had occasion to meet him a few times and listen to his constant complaining, which was somewhat legitimate, but you know, you can always go overboard. But the main thing is that knowing him over the years, having seen him in action over the Balkan situation, I had come to feel that this man is neither considerate of other people nor very stable in terms of some objective. And as a result, he antagonizes a lot of people. The problem that I wanted to get to is that the Obama originally was anointed by the Kennedys, and this was a tremendous conflict between the Kennedys and Clintons that Obama was caught in the middle of. And this is what I think that your author should consider in his evaluation of the situation in Washington, D.C. during the Obama administration.
Okay.
That the man was unreliable as a servant of the Obama presidency, and rather was more of a Clintonista.
Okay, thanks a lot, Dan. So his theory is that this was part of the palace intrigue, was that it was the old Clinton versus Obama power struggle, team of rivals, whatever you want to call it, being played out. Do you buy that?
I think there's certainly truth to that. Mm-hmm. Yes, and there is that very real tension between Clinton's State Department and Obama's White House.
Mm-hmm.
And Holbrooke, as the caller noted, did rub a lot of people the wrong way.
Right.
So. The challenge for the president is you've got to resolve this. You either have to tell your people, all right, Holbrooke's a tough guy to work with, got a big ego, big personality, but he possesses skills and knowledge that dates back to Vietnam, so let's work with him.
Mm-hmm.
Or you say, this guy's too volatile, it doesn't work, and have that a hard talk with Hillary Clinton. But it required a decision one way or another. By simply allowing the infighting to persist, it fundamentally affected not just the war policy, but it was a disservice to all the men and women who were out there serving.
Now, there's a contrast. There are two different paths. Obama chose to make a big splash with a surge. It was made him seem forceful, and it was maybe that's what he thought would work. But there was also an opportunity to take more of a long-range approach to Afghanistan and think about what would happen if we went slowly instead of doing this big sort of bold stroke. Was there a thought to that alternative path? Was that an option that was on the table? Or?
There was some discussion of sort of a go-long strategy. But unfortunately, it really wasn't considered all that seriously. Certainly one of my key characters in the book argues this, that that's really what Afghanistan needed. It didn't need...
A very
smart State Department officer by the name of Cale Weston,
mm-hmm.
who had spent 7 years between Iraq and Afghanistan. And he was at that point stationed in Helmand Province. And he would constantly say to me, look, Afghanistan's a marathon, not a sprint.
Mm-hmm.
And what the United States needs to do is not to surge, not to go big. Not to go home either, but to go long, to show the Afghan people that we will help them over a significant period of time get their act together, to take charge of security, to rebuild their country. Not to do it for them, but to assist them. The problem is that articulating a long-term commitment like that is really politically very difficult. And so that really wasn't on the table. And so instead, we decided to surge, which in many ways sent the wrong message to the Afghan people. It was, for a period of time, we'll do it for you, so you don't have to do it. You don't have to take responsibility. But also it was, at some point, we're leaving because there's no way we could sustain the surge. So it fuels fears of abandonment, as opposed to saying, all right, look, you know, we made a commitment to you after 9/11, coming in to topple the Taliban, that if you sided with us against the Talibs, we give you a shot at a better, freer life. We're here to help you. We're not here to do it for you. But that pragmatic approach doesn't always win out in high-level discussions in Washington.
Now, you spent two and a half years working on the book.
Yes, and traveling back and forth.
And traveling back and forth. How many days on the ground in Afghanistan do you think you spent total?
Boy, I made, by my count, or the stamps on my passport, 15 trips, each of which were anywhere between 2 and 4 weeks at a time. So a fair number of days on the ground.
Did you get much of a sense from talking to civilians, just the average person, whatever the definition of that is in Afghanistan, what the people felt about the U.S. being there? I had actually read somewhere that in some areas of Afghanistan, they weren't even clear as to who the United States was, that there were some people thinking, well, they're still the Soviets. They thought that we were the Soviets. They didn't know, which makes the job of kind of winning hearts and minds tricky if they don't know who you are.
Well, you know, that speaks to how we pushed into some places that were so remote, so irrelevant, that these people are so disconnected from the world. They didn't have any idea what had happened in the past 20 years.
Right.
When you actually talk to Afghan villagers in parts of the South, for instance, it was interesting to me. You know, we're here back here in America, and you see these television images of Afghans rioting, or you know, the aftermath of attacks on our forces. You think they all hate us, and why? You know, why are we there? And indeed, many Afghans are annoyed at the presence, the long term presence, now you know more than a decade of foreign troops on their soil. But when they look at the alternatives, in some cases, you know, they have no great love for the Taliban. They hate their government. In some places, when I talk to Afghans, they actually look at the Americans and say, you know, we're not all that keen about having foreigners here, but you're better than the alternatives. you're protecting us. You're pumping lots of money into our economy. You're giving us freebies. We got all these handouts from you. And, you know, if my kid's sick, I can bring him to the gate of your base and you'll try to treat him. And so they're kind of freaked out that American troops are coming home and worried that either the Taliban will reassert itself or you know, their government will somehow show up and start to exact more bribes from them. And so, you know, they would like us, but, you know, they're not paying the bill here. And, you know, who doesn't want freebies?
Well, let me just ask you a question that I've been thinking about, and probably a lot of other people have, too. I seem to recall that when we originally went to Afghanistan, we had a fairly clearly defined mission, mm-hmm. that we were trying to get bin Laden.
Mm-hmm.
And now, of course, we have gotten bin Laden, not in Afghanistan, but in Pakistan, but that's close. So does that alter the mission in any way, or is this an example of mission creep where now the mission is something completely different, which is, you know, building institutional capacity, remaking an entire country, which seems like a huge undertaking and wasn't the original idea. Where do we go from here now that we've achieved the objective of getting bin Laden? What's the future of our role in Afghanistan?
I mean, Andy, you put your finger on a key disconnect in American policy, and it's been this way for several years now. You know, our goal was always to go after al-Qaeda, but the mission was this grand mission of sort of nation building, of trying to go after the Taliban in Afghanistan, many of whom have no real desire to come and fight Americans in America. Most of whom we don't. They're just poor villagers who are getting paid off to lay bombs or shoot at American troops. And after it was perhaps more politically difficult for the president to unwind prior to the killing of Osama. But now that he's dead, it gives an opening to Obama to continue moving forward on these troop drawdowns, particularly given the cost of this war. And that's a real issue back here, cost in lives, mm-hmm. cost in limbs, and the cost in dollars.
Right.
You know, $100 billion a year to keep the troops there. So by getting bin Laden and by getting a lot of other senior al-Qaeda leaders, all of whom have been or most of whom have been killed in Pakistan, not in Afghanistan,
right.
It does provide political cover for the president to start bringing more forces home.
Okay, I've been speaking with Rajiv Chandrasekaran about his book, Little America, The War Within the War for Afghanistan. You've been a great sport with all these interruptions. It's been published by Knopf. Rajiv, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, it was a lot of fun. Thanks.